FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is March 1st, 2017. So the election's been over for quite a while now. Actually, it's 3 months already. Hard to believe, almost 4 months. But the history has yet to be written. Book has just come out, How Trump Won: The Inside Story of a Revolution. And it's written by two people, Larry Schweikert, who's with us now, Joel Pollack, who's senior editor at large for Breitbart News. Book's got an interesting history. It was actually two books being done separately. The publisher, Regnery Books, kind of put them together, got the authors together to create one book out of two separate books. And Larry, I mean, you've really amazing author, New York Times bestseller. You've written 25 books, and this could perhaps be the most interesting book. You started the book in 2015. You were convinced that Trump was going to be the next president, and you were correct. You're a little bit ahead of me. I became convinced in July of 2015 when I saw Trump speak at the Freedom Fest in Vegas, a libertarian kind of get together that happens every year. Once I was convinced that he was serious about running, I was convinced that he was going to win. And here we are, March 1st, 2017, almost 2 years later, and he's president. So how did he do it? And first of all,
well, welcome. You know, it's interesting you mentioned a speech there in Vegas, because it was also a speech that really convinced me he was going to win. And that would be the speech that he made in Phoenix, I think about 2 weeks before that. And he had moved, I was vacationing in Phoenix at the time, and he had moved the speech from the Biltmore, which was a venue of about 20-some hundred people, to the convention center, which was 14,000 people. And I know Phoenix. I was born and raised here. I said, wait, that does not happen. I mean, nobody just comes in and plans a speech for 1,000 people and then has 15 times that many people show up. So I knew something was going on there. I knew it was big. And when I listened to what he had to say at that speech, and he was highlighting illegal immigration, number one, and jobs and economic recovery, number two, from a very practical and pragmatic perspective, like no one had, I thought, well, this guy can win. And then he gave the stage over to Jamil Shah, who was present last night at the inauguration. Very, very few candidates ever do that. Very few candidates will turn over a major speech stage to someone that nobody's ever heard of. They'll give it to a celebrity, but not somebody. So, you know, I thought right away he was very, very different, and that his use of language was incredibly forthright and blunt and plain. Many, he got criticized for that, for, you know, insulting people or whatnot. But ordinary Americans can relate to that. And I thought, especially if they were tired of the political talk. So anyway, that's how we, you and I, both kind of ended up at the same place from different events.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I remember that. I remember those speeches where you'd have families of the victims of criminal acts, murders, basically, of done by illegal immigrants. And this is something that's been going on for a long, long time, not taken seriously by any of the party politicians. And I said, whoa, wait a second, he's onto something here. And he could potentially, this and a few other issues, ride this into the White House. And here he is. He's done it.
Well, among the other things that happened, he generated a new form of political speech to the American people. I thought that was really critical. He used Twitter better than any president in history. And that's interesting because a friend of mine, Jason Matera, wrote a book called Obama Zombies back in 2009 about the millennials and the youth following Obama. And he made the point that Obama had just crushed McCain in social media. And the numbers were, I mean, they were staggering. I mean, things like 100-1 in YouTube views, 2,000-1 in Twitter account followers, things like that. And so I knew this was important, that this wasn't just a phase. I knew this was something any new politician better get used to. Yeah. Well, at the time frame you're referencing, early summer, Trump had 4 million Twitter followers, which was more than every single other Republican in the race put together. And there were 17 of them. And so that in its end, he was almost at that time almost equal to Hillary's Twitter followers then. And we know later that Hillary was padding her base with a bunch of fake followers that, you know, would be bots and so forth.
Yeah. And then when you look,
so that was one thing, the use of Twitter and new social media that allowed him to go over the heads of the drive-by media.
Yeah. And then when you looked at his YouTube engagement and you looked at hers, I mean, there was no comparison. He had, not only did he have the followers and people watching his videos, but then the shares and the comments and everything else.
Right.
He was so far ahead of Hillary in that respect. There was no comparison.
Well, but there was also something else. And this is one of the things that we reveal in the book that I think everybody's missed. They continue to miss even after his Melbourne, Florida appearance a couple of weeks ago. And that is these rallies. The standard news media take on these rallies is that these are just the most rabid followers, and they don't mean anything because they're just the loyal core. That is true. And these people ended up being the boots on the ground and the people who go call and, you know, walk people to the polls and that kind of stuff. But the real value of the rallies that nobody got is that they allowed Trump to use local media to go over the heads of national media.
Yeah,
so, for example, he's in Phoenix. So he's going to be on all four local channels here in Phoenix, and the nature of local news is that they will give you more time unvarnished. They will give you anywhere from 30 seconds to maybe a full minute without a bunch of commentary, and they don't have a panel of idiots afterwards talking about what you just said, whereas CNN will play maybe 15 to 30 seconds and then cut to 5 minutes of people saying, well, you know, he said this, but he doesn't mean it. And in the local media, you got an absolute reversal of that metric. So your time speaking directly to the people in local markets was huge. It was worth millions and millions of dollars. And I confirmed that with Steve Bannon, his chief strategist and CEO in the campaign. He said, yep, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So, of course, because the local media can't ignore the story, but the national media is only too happy to ignore the story. And I don't agree that just because, well, look, his last rally in Michigan, which nobody expected him to win, Larry, he had 31,000 people there. So you can't just tell
me. Let me tell you about that Michigan rally.
Right.
I had a source on the ground, a local pollster in, the county escapes me now. It's right north of Detroit. It's a swing county, but more Democrat.
It was Warren.
It'll come to me in a minute.
Warren, Michigan, I think, maybe.
It's in the book. Anyway, this was a key county, and a Democrat can't win Michigan without winning this county. Trump did a rally in that county, and the one that you said had 31,000 people, and my source, this pollster, was on the ground at that rally. He said, I have never seen so many blue-collar union workers at a Republican rally in my life. He told me, and this was a week before the election, he said, Trump is up at least by one here in Michigan. And if he just doesn't get destroyed out of Detroit, he will win Michigan. And so I was pretty sure going in, I thought he was going to win Michigan.
Yeah, and let's not forget, Detroit has lost a lot of its population and a lot of the machine that other presidents Democrats have relied upon to sweep them into the White House there.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about another Democrat city, Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
Because I was teaching at the University of Dayton at the time. And another thing early in 2016 that told me Trump had Ohio in the bag. And in fact, I was texting people at Team Trump saying, you're wasting time in Ohio. You've got it. Ohio is in the bag. Well, why did I think that? Cuyahoga County, which is Ohio's version of Detroit, heavily Democratic. In early 2016, there were new published reports of voter registration changes. And the upshot is that a Democrat has to win Cuyahoga County by about 175,000 votes to even have a hope of carrying Ohio. Well, these voter registration changes showed that the Democrats were down in Cuyahoga County alone by almost 100,000 votes. And just there's no way you can win Ohio and you know, start off in Cuyahoga down 100,000 votes. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
So I was telling this to Team Trump, similar things. We were following similar changes in Florida and North Carolina. And then the other thing that we were tracking was this very low rate of participation by blacks, especially in North Carolina, Florida, and Pennsylvania, where they were down anywhere from 3 to 8%. And in fact, Philadelphia, Hillary got crushed in Philadelphia. She won it big, but in terms of how she did versus Obama in 2012, it wasn't even close. Trump got 250,000 more votes in Pennsylvania than Romney did in 2012.
Yeah. And then Milwaukee, I should say Wisconsin, I knew that he was going to win there because, again, the same thing as Michigan, you know, Milwaukee, you have to win Milwaukee by a lot to take the entire state, especially those northern suburbs. You've got to win them as well.
Well, if you called Wisconsin, you get a gold star because you're the only person I know anywhere. We didn't call Wisconsin. We had no idea that he was going to win.
Can I tell you why? And this was the genius of Trump. Okay. Reince Priebus and Scott Walker. Okay. And that's why he won Wisconsin. All right. You got the inside track. Scott Walker really went to bat for Trump in spite of the acrimony of the primaries. And that's why I knew he was going to win it. Plus, it's, I call the Midwest the Brexit states. The only reason why he lost Minnesota was because of the voter fraud. And I called Iowa as well. Iowa.
Let me give you some inside info on Minnesota. One of the things that happened during this this campaign was I got to know the most accurate pollster in the entire 2016 campaign, People's Pundit Daily. Mm-hmm. They had the national race at Hillary 1.5, but they had Trump winning Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Michigan in their last poll, but they did not have Wisconsin. Here's what Richard Barris, the head of People's Pundit Daily, told me about Minnesota. Their polling, as the election drew closer, showed Trump surging like crazy. On election day, outside of Minneapolis, Trump won Minnesota 2-1. What flipped Minnesota, he said, was the Access Hollywood tape that affected early voting. Trump lost early voting in Minnesota pretty big, and a lot of that came right during that Access Hollywood tape. He also confirmed what I thought and was told by Bannon, that Trump lost New Hampshire, really, because of the Access Hollywood tape. Without that, he would have won New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess people just don't read about WikiLeaks. What can you do? You know, the WikiLeaks was far worse than any four-letter word Trump could have strung together, or a six-letter word, but that's just my opinion.
Well, what all this comes down to is a very amazing statistic because, you know, you can look at the glass half full or glass half empty. Mm-hmm. Trump barely won in a number of states. That's true. Hillary racked up this very large popular vote in California and New York that is, you know, fairly meaningless. That's true. But here's the number that certainly Democrats want to ignore. Mm-hmm. In seven states, Maine, New Hampshire, Virginia, Minnesota, New Mexico, Colorado, and Nevada, Trump lost those seven states by a total of 510,000 votes.
Yeah.
Now, the flip factor, if you're a politician, you're going, how many votes do I have to flip next time to win those seven states? The flip factor is 270,000 votes. Are you kidding me? As we said, Trump got 250,000 more votes in one state alone, Pennsylvania, from 2012. So if I'm a Democrat strategist and I'm looking at that number and not drinking Kool-Aid, I'm going, holy crap, we were 500,000 votes away from an almost 370 vote blowout.
Mm-hmm. Well, I knew he was going to win Florida. There was never a question in my mind about it. And never, because he took the Cuban population And the fact that the Democrats got them for Obama was an anomaly, a true anomaly. They'd always been hardcore Republican. I never understood how Obama got them. Never could understand that. But
well, here's some tidbits about Florida, because I had two different guys in our group. We called us the Renegade Deplorables, and we were all working stats from different parts of the country. And as I said, we found early on that black voting, early voting, absentee voting in Florida was down 3%. 3% in Florida, 115,000 votes.
Yep.
And Obama only won Florida by 75,000. So that's huge in and of itself. But you'll love this story. On election day itself, one of the guys who didn't want to be identified in the book, he flew up to be with Team Trump in New York. Mm-hmm. And he calls me when he gets there on election day. He goes, we're losing Florida. Oh, my gosh, the votes are coming in. We're losing Florida. And I said, no, you're not. What you're seeing are the early and absentee votes being posted first. And those had a Democrat lead. But we always catch up on election day. And so I had to talk Team Trump off the ledge there. I said, just relax. When that panhandle comes in, you'll be in good shape. And
panhandle.
Sure enough, it went that way.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. No, I knew he was going to win Florida, Iowa. You know, it went for Cruz in the primary, but that looked like there was a lot of shenanigans going on there.
Let's talk about Cruz, because I think a lot of Trump voters started off as Cruz supporters. And I think Cruz had a problem that really hasn't yet been identified in the mainstream media. And that was he kind of began his race as the Christian conservative. And everyone expected that he, not Trump, would take all the evangelical voters. And I think since you mentioned the shenanigans, I think what really happened to Ted was, if you're going to run as the Holy Joe, for want of a better word, if you're going to run as Holy Joe, you cannot have the slightest whiff of scandal.
You better walk on water.
In Iowa,
you better walk on water.
Exactly. You know, when the National Enquirer stuff, and by the way, I'm convinced if Cruz had been the nominee, you would have seen 50 mistresses come out of the woodwork.
Oh, my God.
Right or wrong, you know, true or false, it wouldn't matter. They would have had him coming out.
Yeah, I'm sure it was true. I mean, I've got some inside sources from his behavior when he was in Texas. And look, none of us are saints, okay? But don't run as a saint when you're a sinner.
That's right.
Okay?
That's right.
Like you said, the number one rule of politics for when you're going to run for the Christian right is, you know, you better have nothing to hide.
Better be pure.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, that's why hypocrisy, people could accuse Trump of hypocrisy and it didn't matter because he never pretended to run as a saint and his background was out there for everyone to see. And so it's one of the reasons why people better give up accusing Democrats of being hypocrites, because they don't claim to be saints and that's not going to work on them.
They're proud hypocrites. They're proud hypocrites. I mean, look, let's face the facts here. They're proud of it. And, you know, they just call out the hypocrisy on the right. Rightfully so. And look, don't hold yourself out to be something you're not. And nobody likes a hypocrite, regardless what side of the aisle they're on. So, hey, let's get back to how things turned out. So when you look at the states, all right, so certain states are just so predictable, you don't even have to look at them. The states that are interesting is Pennsylvania. Let's go back to that for a minute. That one surprised me. I really didn't believe that he was going to turn it, because Philadelphia, and to a lesser extent, Pittsburgh, got a really rich history of voter fraud. They don't even have polling places in public places. They have them like in Italian restaurants. You know, you could not get away with that.
But I mean, you can't get pasta when you go to vote, right?
Yeah. Well, like in Florida, we have polling places in nursing homes. So maybe the dead can't vote in Florida, but the almost dead are just as likely to vote here. But in Pennsylvania, I remember reading a story of a guy, he was a poll watcher, and he shows up at his polling place and it's literally an Italian restaurant. No one is even voting there. And the guy who's running it, is a little bit connected. And he says, you know, this is the way it's going to work. And the guy is just not going to argue with him. And at the end, they've consumed X number of bottles of wine and they go into the machines and they're just pulling levers, the old machines. Yeah. That's the way it works in Philly. And, you know, you had it during Obama, where far more number of people voted in certain districts than were registered. Yeah.
Well, here's what I think happened in Pennsylvania. And Selena Zito, who is a very good writer, was on this from the beginning. She's a Pittsburgh native. And she constantly was going outside of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And she found overwhelming support for Trump there. We're not talking about just marginal support. We're talking about overwhelming support. So the only question was, how many votes could you get out of Philadelphia? And I, as I pointed out before, the key was African-American support was down 3-4% in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And without that, the numbers just aren't there. I said that Trump had about 250,000 more votes than Romney, but Hillary had many, many thousand votes fewer than Obama. Not just there, but in Wisconsin and in Michigan. And, you know, you mentioned Florida. The interesting thing is that in Florida, Hillary outperformed Obama, and she outperformed him in Ohio, too, and still got scobbed. It's because Trump would have beaten Obama in either Florida or Ohio, but not Pennsylvania or Michigan this time around. So, you know,
fascinating.
Pennsylvania was indeed a key, and Trump way overperformed and Hillary underperformed.
Yeah, I just that's the state that really shocked me. Michigan could have gone either way, although I had it leaning towards towards Trump. I knew that Trump was going to win. I just, you know, Pennsylvania, and he won by 70,000 or 45,000 votes, whatever it came out to,
right,
you know, pretty substantially. But
right.
But Wisconsin, I just knew because he had the machine tied up there. In Ohio, I knew because basically they kicked out Kasich and the National Party took control of the state machine because Kasich was an obstructionist and he had to be dealt with.
Yeah.
So at that point, it was clear that Ohio was going to go for Trump. There's no way they were going to vote for Hillary. And like I say, Minnesota surprised me, but not really, because they did vote for McGovern. They were the one state that voted for him, so you just never know with them. And
well, about three weeks out from the election, I got an internal poll from the Trump campaign that showed them down just one or two in Minnesota, down just three in Oregon, ahead in New Mexico, tied basically in Colorado and Nevada, and very close in places like Delaware. And I said, I texted them, I said, are these numbers accurate? And I listed them all. I said, yeah, that's what we're showing right now. And then came the Access Hollywood tape, and a lot of those numbers flipped with that tape. But I think the other interesting story of this campaign that is the poll. And as we said, the polls were wrong. They're going to cover themselves by saying they were right nationally, which is totally irrelevant because none of the pollsters except PPD, none of them had Michigan or Pennsylvania, and most of them had Hillary winning Florida or North Carolina. And so what you had was this national polling network that was basically perpetrating lies. And in the book, we conclude, and this is confirmed by a source, that Hillary basically stopped internal polling toward the end because she was so convinced that the national polls were right. They didn't need to do any more internal polling. They did some, but nothing like what they should have done. And so it's ironic that in the end, she was basically lied to by the fake poll network that was lying to the American people.
Yeah, might have suppressed some of her turnout as well, ironically. Sure. So, yeah, well, interesting. So the book, I'm sure, is selling well and probably want to go
it's
out.
In audio form already, yes.
All right.
And we've already got inquiries into German translation. It'll be in Walmart. It'll be in Barnes & Noble, of course, anywhere where books are sold.
Right. The book is How Trump Won, The Inside Story of a Revolution, which it truly was. Two authors, Larry Schweikart and Joel Pollack. Sounds like incredible reading, and it really was a shocker to just about everybody in the country except you, me, and a few others, Larry.
Right.
I mean, my friends would be like, God, if Trump doesn't win, it's going to be the end of the country, which may or may not have been the truth. Who knows? But I would just tell them, look, he's going to win. Just stop worrying about it. Just go to sleep, go have a drink, whatever you need to do to unwind, he's going to win. Yeah, but the polls, I said, just stop looking at the polls, turn off the news. I mean, even Fox News was like, it's all over.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
I had to get off Twitter in the main part of Twitter and just go in the chat room with the Renegade Deplorables, because the people were just freaking out. So, oh, we're going to lose. Oh, no. Oh, my God. Oh, it's terrible. Oh, Florida, Florida. You know.
Yeah. Well, I knew that he was going to win. There was never a doubt in my mind. You know, just never a doubt. It's maybe I was crazy and it just came out to be that he won, but I knew that he was going to win. You know, it just had to be, you know, because the people were not happy in the country, right? I mean, were they happy here?
Well, no. And then, you know, there was one other thing that I think the media has totally gotten wrong. Mm-hmm. And that is that Trump speak and kind of how he handles and frames issues involves a lot of combativeness, and where George W. Bush, whether you think his policies are right or wrong, fact is for 8 years, the Democrats hammered him. And as a matter of strategy, he and Karl Rove did not respond in any way.
Right.
They thought it was more important to just do what they were going to do and history would tell the tale. Well, fact is that, you know, perceptions become reality. And if you get hammered without response for 8 years, I don't care who you are, you're going to start to see numbers move in terms of support. And that's why. So Trump figured that out early on. He would not take any kind of attack at all, and he would counterattack. Now, what he also learned, and Scott Adams of Dilbert fame really dwelled into this, he has a certain speaking style and a strategic style that basically sends the media off into chasing the way I put it is every day Trump wakes up and he puts a little block of cheese in a maze.
Exactly.
And the media chases the cheese while he goes about and does the things that he wants to do. It's this little diversion every day, whether it's talking about a Hispanic judge or talking about McCain's war record or whatever it is. And Kellyanne, the latest is Kellyanne Conway on her knees on a sofa taking a picture. This is a big deal. And that picture is shot out throughout the country. And what does it show? 80 black college heads talking with Trump. That's the picture everybody sees. What picture people saw in the Democrat convention of Khazir Khan was not this man talking about his son, this proud Muslim. What they saw was a Muslim woman in submission standing there quiet while her husband spoke. That's what people saw.
Uh-huh.
And so Trump has a way of framing these things by throwing out this piece of cheese almost daily while he just relentlessly goes about doing what he's going to do.
I wrote a story about this. So here's the deal. I was watching, and we got to wrap up, but I'm watching a CBS reporter being interviewed about how they cover Trump. And what they do, they have somebody get up at 5:30 in the morning to check out his latest Twitter feed. Mm-hmm. And then that person, depending on what's in the feed, calls up other reporters and says, yeah, you better get on this because he said this about Muslims or, you know, or he said this about trade or this about Russia or China or whatever. And he dictates their assignments. And picture that in every newsroom on the planet, you know, and then he sends them off on a wild goose chase. And he says, all right, he calls his staff in and says, what do we got planned for today? And that's
exactly
what happens.
Right. And if you saw the Kellyanne Conway thing, well, they're busy talking about that. He signed two more executive orders that were very, very important. So
it's
funny.
You know, it really is, because they're just being trolled and played and diverted and distracted. And I don't even know if they're smart enough to know it or... you know, they're pretty dense when you get down to it.
Well, Larry. I was in Trump Tower about a month ago, just before the inauguration, and I met with Bannon, and he was laughing. He said, do you think they'll get it? And he meant the media and the Democrats. Do you think they'll catch on to what we're doing? I said, not a chance, because they're too arrogant.
Yeah.
They think they know the answers. They've got the playbook that's worked for the last 40 years. And so now they're convinced that all they need to do is run that playbook. And there's, what was it Eddie Murphy said in the one movie? There's a new sheriff in town. His name's Reggie Hammond.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, it's absurd that they could fall for it every single day of the week. And, you know, I wrote this article.
Lucy in the football. Yeah. It's Lucy in the football.
Yeah. It's like, I wrote this article, The Workaholic in Chief. And he's up at 5:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. He sends out his Twitter thing. Maybe he's even got it scheduled. So he, maybe he doesn't even bother with it. Who knows? It doesn't really matter. It's kind of irrelevant when you think about it. It's the Twitter feed. Sometimes, yeah, sometimes it's got to do with it. And, you know, they've gotten their licks in on him. Let's face it. You know, when they attack his wife and his kids and all that, can't feel good. But in the final analysis, he gets them back pretty good because he's got them going all over the place, like with chickens with their heads cut off, and they don't even know what they're doing there, you know? He ought to just send somebody out.
You mentioned workaholic, and we got time for this. Let me just flip this in. You know, supposedly Obama has a shadow government that is organizing to interrupt or stop Trump. And one of the problems of this is that for 8 years, Obama was anything but a workaholic. He took more vacations than any president in history.
I mentioned
and,
that.
And if he had had Trump's work ethic, we would be sunk as a nation. The nation would already be finished because all of that agenda would not only be implemented, it would be implemented in a way you could never repeal it. But thank God that he was a vacationer.
A slacker. He was a slacker. Yeah. Well, I mentioned that also, that he would do anything he could, everything in his power to avoid putting in a full day at the Oval Office, you know?
Sure.
He'd be watching sports, ESPN, anything he could do just to avoid it. I mean, that was that's the nature of those guys. But Trump, you know, 20 hours a day, and he's surrounding himself with workaholics as well. I mean, that's
intern at Trump Tower. I said, does Bannon ever sleep? And they said, not much. And I said, well, does Trump ever sleep? He goes, less than Bannon.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. And then you look at the generals. Those guys don't sleep. And then, you know, Rex Tillerson, he didn't get there by working 6 hour or 4 hour days, you know, and, you know, go down the line. I mean, I can't say for the Washington insiders, I don't know, but if they're not performing, they'll be out the door pretty quick, you know?
That's right.
Yeah. So that's why, and Rudy Giuliani, he was known when he was mayor of New York, he had a cot in the basement of City Hall. And during the week, he never went home. He just slept. Took cat naps in the basement. I mean, that's that's what the guy did. So that's they have no idea what's in store for them. So I would like to just see Trump kind of Twitter out something really major is going on in the Aleutian Islands. we've got to get on it right away. This could destroy the administration. You know, oops.
They can send them for 6 months.
Yeah, and then delete it right away. Oops, shouldn't have done that. Delete it. And then all these reporters go up to the Aleutian Islands, freezing their butts off. What was he talking about? What the heck? I don't understand. We're here. What did he mean? Just to troll them over there, right? Wouldn't you love it?
Yeah, that would be terrific.
Well, and they do it, you know? They would definitely do it, wouldn't they?
I think certainly that they wake up every day and they have in mind that, you know, there's a diversionary practice for the press almost daily.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it would be a lot of fun to just send them off on wild goose chases and, you know, let's send them off to the most disgusting hellholes on the planet. And you could do like, where's Waldo? Where are the reporters? And just keep sending them there for like trivial matters, right? Oh, you know, something happened to General Mattis and he's in the Aleutians. Oops. Shouldn't have done that.
He's in Venezuela now.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Oh, oops. No, where is he now? You know, and just keep them going. They don't even know how they're being played. And
well, yeah. I am proposing to the publisher that we have a follow-up book called How Trump Keeps Winning.
Yeah. Hey, I like that. That's good. You know, and look, I didn't mention before, but my prior life as an attorney did a couple of minor matters for him. And I was up in Trump Tower talking to him. The guy is not stupid here. Like, he's made out to be by the press. I mean, I don't know where this meme came from that Trump is a stupid buffoon. The guy happens to be very bright on the uptake. He's no dummy. Let's dispense with that one right away. He's not a stupid person. All right.
Right.
And he is successful.
I was in the Oval Office in 2006 with a number of historians like John Keegan and Victor Davis Hanson with President Bush talking military history. We were over in there for over an hour and a half. And he, by all means, was not stupid. He not only knew all the books and the scholarly stuff that was being written about, but he knew the point of all of them and what, you know, authors, where their direction was and everything else. So I think this is just kind of a standard thing that the left uses.
Yeah, just a meme. All right. Well, hey, so Larry, just tell us the book, Amazon, obviously Barnes and Noble's, all the places. You have a blog or a website we can find you?
Sure. PatriotsHistoryUSA.com, all one word. PatriotsHistoryUSA.com has all my books. Book is How Trump Won. It's available by Blackstone in audio. It's available at Walmart, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and it's a terrific read.
All right. So we will have a link to this site in our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Any questions, comments on this interview or others, send me an email, kl@carrielutz.com. That's kl@carrielutz.com. Twitter feed is @CarrieLutz. We'll tweet this out. And the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Oh, by the way, I keep forgetting to mention this. It's really easy to subscribe to the show. So if you've got the iTunes program, either on a Mac or a PC, you just go to the iTunes store, type in Carrie Lutz or Financial Survival Network. Show comes up. You click the subscribe button. Automatically, every time we do a new show, it comes right to your computer. You just click it and listen, and you can do that on your smartphones. You can do it on your tablets, all that. Larry, it's been a total pleasure. It's been fun hearing the inside stories here. It kind of jives with what I thought was going on already, and it must have been a lot of fun writing the book, kind of writing history before it happens, and I'd love to have you and your co-author come back at some point in the future and kind of talk about these stories and fill us in on everything we wanted to know, but nobody's told us about.
Absolutely. Anytime. And you know how to get a hold of me through the Rigmarie Publicist.
Yeah. We totally want you on and want to hear all the deep, dark secrets there, because he was Joel Pollack, senior editor at large for Breitbart. He was in there. And he also wrote an article not too long ago that Steve Bannon is not an anti-Semite, doesn't hate us Jews, which I never had any doubt about. But another meme perpetrated by the mainstream, lamestream, or what I like best, Larry, is legacy media.
Legacy. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you, Carrie. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's been a total pleasure. Great luck on the book. I'm going to pick up a copy now. Good luck.
All right. See ya.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.